Hi, this is Bill Ringel, host of My Quest for the Best, where we meet business thought and community leaders to discuss issues relevant to entrepreneurial growth. Joining us today is Michael Bungay Stanier. Michael founded Box of Crayons, a company that helps organizations all over the world do less good work and more great work. The Box of Crayons company is well known for their coaching programs that help time crunch managers coach in 10 minutes or less. Michael left Australia 22 years ago to be a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University, where he fell in love with a Canadian, and that explains why he now lives in Toronto. He's the author of Do More, Great Work, which has sold over 100,000 copies, and several other books, including his most recent, The Coaching Habit, Say Less, Ask More, and Change the Way You Lead Forever. Welcome, Michael.
Bill, I'm so happy to be back with you. It's nice to talk again, and thanks for bringing me on and getting into this new book I've written, The Coaching Habit.
It's a fascinating book, and I can't wait to get in talking about it. How did you realize that you had a knack or an inclination for coaching? Was there some early experience in your life or in school that led you to draw upon skills or revealed to you that this was an area that you had a good value to offer?
Yeah, you know, there really was, so it's a great question to start. In those angst-filled teenage years, like we've all been there, we've all had them, where, you know, love is intense and hate is intense and, you know, the emotions ebb and flow, you know, the brain isn't fully formed, so you truly don't know what you're doing. I found that in those days, I spent an awful lot of time listening to my fellow teenagers and their angst-filled love life. And it may be because I didn't have much of a love life myself, who knows. But the typical thing was we'd go out, we'd go dancing, we'd do something like that, and then there'd be a drive home, and I'd end up sort of listening to somebody in a car, my friend Phil springs to mind, talking about the angst he's having with, you know, insert girl's name. And I remember feeling right there at the time going, God, you know, I am obviously okay at this whole listening thing. I've got a degree of sympathetic ear. But I really have no idea what I'm doing here. You know, I'm barely holding on. Should I be saying something? Should I be asking something? What should I be doing? I mean, being present is useful, but what else? And when I went to university, one of the things that I did is I took a telephone crisis counseling course. So effectively a suicide hotline for teens. And that was my first kind of formal training in this area. It's just so that I had a sense of how might you respond when somebody's struggling. And I did that in university in Australia. I did it in university in the UK as well. And when I finally finished university, got into the world of work, after a number of years, I actually then started to notice of the rise of this thing called coaching. Now, I was in the UK at the time. And, of course, it was very much a kind of U.S. and really a kind of Californian thing. And because I'm in the U.K., I'm like, it's probably this hippy-dippy, slightly odd thing from the West Coast. We can probably ignore it. But it kept my attention, and I kept tracking that. And then when I moved to the States, I hired my first coach, found out what she did, figured out that this is something that I could probably do as well. And that really was when I started walking that path of more formally coaching people myself. And, of course, these days I actually don't do very much coaching anymore myself. My real focus is training managers and leaders to be more effective coaches in their day-to-day working lives.
What was it like the first time you worked with a client who said, I want to learn more effective communication skills, and you realized that you needed to introduce them to this body of coaching that could help them get more business results?
It's been interesting because one of the things that I've noticed in the years as coaching has become increasingly kind of mainstream has been the different ways that it's been positioned for people. So when it started, coaching was very much about if you're getting coaching, you're probably broken. You know, you've screwed up somehow. You know, coaching is just a code word for we're going to fire you in 3 months' time, but we're going to do this token thing before we get there. The year 2000, Daniel Goleman, who, you know, you may know, most people do know that name as the guy who popularized emotional intelligence. Daniel Goleman publicized an article in Harvard Business Review called Leadership That Gets Results. And he says, look, there are actually six different styles of leadership. They're all useful. They're all appropriate at certain times. but they don't always work, and each one, each style has its own pros and cons. He identified coaching as a style of leadership, but he said, you know, even though it really has a great job driving engagement and driving kind of cultural change and driving even bottom line success, it's perceived as taking too long and too much effort for it to be a much used leadership style. And what I've noticed over the time is that the focus now has turned into, we know that we need to keep our people focused on the stuff that matters, and we need to keep people engaged so that they're doing work that's meaningful for them. And one of the things that's just become clear is that coaching is a style of leadership that is particularly effective at bringing focus and engagement and learning to the experience, which isn't something that other styles of leadership may not be able to do quite as well. I don't think I really answered your question there, but there's an answer for you anyway.
It really talks to the difference in your philosophy of how you bring this to a very results-oriented business service. You're not just doing the job and leaving, but you're actually doing kind of a brain upload so that they take those skills and it becomes cross-pollinated throughout the organization, isn't it?
Right. I mean, that's the whole point about coaching is, I mean, there are many, many definitions of what coaching is. There's one that I've read that I think is particularly strong. It's from a guy called Sir John Whitmore. And Sir John says, look, coaching is about helping people unlock their own potential. So I like the way he's kind of been clear about it. It's not you unlocking their potential, but helping others unlock their own potential. And then he says it's about helping people learn rather than teaching them. And that's a really key distinction, because if you're teaching them, it's effectively pretty much I'm downloading the content in my brain into your brain. And I'm going to hope that that's the way you know, I hope you're going to take something away from that. But honestly, most people don't remember very much from being told what to do or given the answer or given the advice. Helping them learn is when you help them make their own connections. And that's when the new neural pathways kind of happen in the brain. That's when people with potential and capacity and self-sufficiency all increase. And just as you're saying, it's about giving people that ability to learn and be self-sufficient, not just telling them what to do.
Michael, what is an example of working with an executive that you've done where you've helped them uncover their own potential? And it's a new way of thinking. So were there any obstacles that you encountered as you were working with an executive?
Well, I work less with executives now. I used to do quite a lot of that in the past. Now my goal, of course, is to help other folks, typical managers, typical leaders, ordinary people in organizations, try and do the same. So if they're working with somebody on their team and they're going, let me help you get to the next level, there's a couple of challenges and maybe a couple of tools I can share that can be particularly helpful for people. The first is this whole piece around, as the coach, as, you know, as the person who's their manager and their leader, the first thing to do is go, look, the basic behavior change that you're looking to complete here to make your life more effective is to give a little less advice and to offer up a little more curiosity. A little less advice, a little more curiosity. Now, I mean, that's harder to do than it sounds, but most people don't realize just how wired they are to be advice-giving maniacs. I mean, they love that stuff. So you're already making a shift of behavior, so you're staying in a place of curiosity. And then one of the most effective things that you can do is to help them increase their own learning as well as be more effective in the work that they're doing. And I'm going to say that one question that people might like immediately is the third question that we talk about in the book. It's called the focus question. And the focus question acknowledges that in many organizations, people are very busily, very creatively, with best of intentions, coming up with answers to solve the wrong problems. It's very frustrating. So the focus question is about helping slow down the rush to action and actually spend time trying to figure out what the real challenge might be. So what is that question? Well, it's pretty simple. It's simply to ask, what's the real challenge here for you? So imagine this, you know, Bill, let's pretend that you report to me, Bill, and you come into my office or my cubicle and you go, Michael, blah, 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 this challenge, blah, blah, blah. And because I'm a nice guy and because I'm helpful and because this is the way we work now for years, every part of my body is twitching and kind of wanting to tell you what to do. But I'm going to change that because you've been listening to Bill Ringel's podcast, so you know, try something different. And so you lean in and you go, okay. So Bill, I understand you've got a lot going on there, but let me ask you, what's the real challenge here for you? And that's going to slow you down. And it's going to actually make you think, because I didn't ask, what's the challenge here? Because you've kind of given me that already. I didn't even ask just, what's the real challenge here? Because that would have still deepened the conversation. I actually asked you, what's the real challenge here for you? And now the focus is on you and what you're up to. And when we get to the heart of what that is, what's the real challenge here for you? When I ask what's the real challenge here for you, and we kind of stick with that question for a little bit, you're going to find that A, you've got better focus on what really needs to be done, but you're also going to walk away with some insight as to how you're part of the issue and what you need to do to overcome your own challenges so that you can better answer this problem that's in front of you. So there's that kind of double whammy. You're solving the problem, you're also increasing learning so that person's capacity and wisdom is increased.
Michael, I see another outcome of this question that's extremely powerful. May I point it out?
Yeah, please.
I see that what you're doing is you're also training people that when they come to you or to their manager who asks this question, they're learning to come prepared to explain what's the problem here, what's the challenge for me, and it goes back to the piece of wisdom that's so hard to follow but so often cited, which is be part of the solution, not the problem. You take ownership by answering that question. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on, and I'd frame it like this. What you're helping people do is to train them in being well-coached. I mean, if you're trying to create a way of working with the people around you that's more coach-like, you want to change your behavior, but you want to help other people change their behavior so they know things are differently. So things will be different. I mean, at the moment, probably people are showing up to have a conversation with you expecting a certain thing, and it may be in some form or other, they're expecting for you to give them the answer. You know, like, just have to wait a bit, and we're going to get the answer out of them eventually, so we'll just do that. What you're trying to do is go, look, we're going to be doing things differently around here, so here's what I'm going to be doing, but here's what your role in this is as well. And actually, it's a very sweet thing when actually you, the person you're working with, understands what's happening as well as you do, because it makes the system even more effective and more efficient. So I think your insight's spot on there, Bill.
Can you talk about an example where this was implemented within a company? And this change, I'm sure, is part of other changes. Transform the culture. What are some things that you observed in one instance as someone who helped introduce these tools to catalyze the change?
Well, I love how you frame that, because, you know, effectively what Box of Crayons is these days is it's a training company. We train busy managers so that they can coach in 10 minutes or less. And that's the only focus we have as a company. And we reckon we do that pretty well. But the challenge with training is that it doesn't really work. It's very frustrating for everybody involved, for the learning and development department and organizations, for the participants, for the trainers like me or the training companies like Box of Crayons. And there are a couple of reasons why it doesn't work. The first is most training programs don't think hard enough about the behavior change that's required. How do you shift from new insights into new actions? How do you help people do things differently when they walk out the door? But the other key place where these things fall short, in my opinion, is that they're often, I would say, non-strategic, meaning there's a kind of ad hoc, let's just throw some training at people and hope that works, as opposed to thinking through, what are we trying to create as a culture around here? How as an organization are we trying to evolve and grow? What's the business imperative that we're looking to deliver against? And knowing that, you then get to construct a program that can help deliver that. One of the areas of focus, one of our bigger clients is one of the big banks here in Canada. And, you know, their business imperative was to strengthen their mid to senior leadership group. Because they're like, you know what, our bench strength isn't as strong as it might be. And of course, you can always go out and hire bench strength. And even well, an additional tool to that is looking at the bench strength you've currently got and going, how do we strengthen that so that they're not just experienced technically, but they're more sophisticated, compassionate, useful leaders. And that's the work we help them do, trying to build that bench strength out so that you had both technical and kind of leadership expertise in good levels on at that mid to senior level.
You also refer to the awe question, which is something that people who are looking to solve problems quickly and maybe not even the correct problems will skip over because it requires curiosity to ask it. Could you talk about how that fits into the toolbox that you deliver to companies?
Yeah, sure. So the awe question, we also call it the best coaching question in the world. It's question number two in the book, and it's a beauty. And of course, when I say it's the best coaching question in the world, people get quite excited, and you know, people listening in have got their pen and paper out or their gadgets out there waiting to write down the question. And it's the awe question in the book because AWE is actually an acronym, AWE, for the three words that are part of this question. So it's pretty simple, just three words, AWE. And that question is, insert drum roll here, it is, and what else? Now, I have this feeling that as soon as I say that, it's slightly anticlimactic for everybody. Everybody goes, oh, really? And what else? That's it? But here's my take on it, Bill. And what else works really well for two reasons. The first is, the first answer somebody gives you is never the only answer, and it's rarely the best answer. And one of the things that happens in our busy organizational life is that we get the first answer and we go, brilliant, we've got an answer, carry on, and you charge on down the road. You heard me say that the change of behavior that I'm trying to achieve here is a little less advice giving and a little more curiosity. The other thing we're trying to achieve is a little less rush to action. Just slow down the action a little bit so that when you move more effectively and more efficiently. So that's the first reason why and what else works so well, is it makes you realize that there's always more. It's probably better as well, and that the first answer is rarely the best answer. The second insight here, though, is that and what else is also a really great self-management tool. Because where most people go is once they've asked the question and they get the answer, they're into advice-giving, solution-providing, action-generating mode, and that doesn't always work. If you ask the question, and what else, because you've asked the question, the other person is back doing the work, and you're getting to stay lazy. And it's one of those kind of slightly counterintuitive principles we have in the book, which is we actually want people to be lazy so that they're better able to coach the other person. The other person gets to do the work and gets the benefit of the insight, the learning, increasing their own capacity, increasing their own potential. So that's a double whammy about why the and what else question works so well.
So the converse of that is if a manager finds him or herself working too hard, the focus is probably back on them providing them with their mentee with a solution rather than them helping develop and cultivate the kind of thinking that'll make them a more valuable asset within the company.
Yeah, exactly. And I love how you put that. It's in some ways that's a nice way to kind of do a little self-management test, which is when you're in a conversation with somebody, you know, every now and then see if you can notice who's doing all the work here. And if you're working hard and the other person isn't, something's gone wrong in the dynamic and you need to kind of flip it around so that you get to ask the questions and they get to do the work.
What are some of the ways that you help people use these tools so that they become second nature? Because you're fighting against years, perhaps decades, of orientation in the old way. And under stress, that's what emerges. So how do you help people be successful with these tools?
Yeah, I mean, we do a number of little things in the program to help them with that. But if there's one thing at the very heart of it all, and it's at the heart of the book as well, I mean, it's actually the first chapter in the book, it's about teaching people how to build new habits. Because habits are the building blocks of our behavior. They are the small actions that we're in a groove around that actually determine at least 50% of our waking behavior is purely habitual. So you need to understand how habits work to change your behavior. It's as simple as that. And of course, there's some terrible information out there on the internet about how habits work. I mean, just disastrous. The classic is, you know, if you do it for 21 days, it becomes a habit. Now, I can tell you straight off, that's just completely wrong. Somebody just made that up. But what's good is there's a ton of good information about habit building that's out there in the world. Everything from, you know, Charles Duhigg's book called The Power of Habit, which I think is great. The other one is terrific, is called BJ Fogg. He has a great website called tinyhabits.com, and that's worth taking a look at as well. And in the book, we actually get into a formula. You call it the New Habit Formula. Very simple, but it's a way of helping people understand how to build a habit. And here are the three parts. Step number one is that you identify what the trigger is. That's kind of the cue, the thing that sets you off. And we identify that by using the phrase, when this happens. When this happens, dot, dot, dot. And you identify the situation. So let's say, when this happens, when Bill walks into my office and goes, Michael, how do I do this? Which he does every week. Step two is you define the old habit, the thing you want to change, the behavior you want to do differently. So I might go, okay, so when Bill walks into my office and says, Michael, how do I do this? Instead of telling him how to do it, as I always do, I just give him the answer so he'll leave me alone. And then you get to the third step, and that is when you define the new habit. But what's the twist on this is that you define the new habit so that it takes place, or you can complete it, in a minute or less, 60 seconds or less. And what's lovely is that asking a question always takes less than a minute. So here's how my new habit would sound. When Bill walks into my office, you know, when this happens, Bill walks into my office and says, Michael, how do I do this? I don't know how to do it. Instead of telling, okay, Bill, here's how you do it, and I told you this last time and the time before that, but here's how you get it done. Thirdly, the third step, I will say instead, Bill, let me ask you, what's the real challenge here for you? And what's going to happen is I'm going to start going, okay, I've now got a really specific situation, a specific person, and I'm going to build a specific new habit as a response to that, so I don't default back to an old way of working that isn't serving me so well. So that's a long answer, but that's the essence to your question, which is around, so how do you get people to do things differently when they walk out the door or when they read the book? And it's about start by understanding how to build a good new habit.
And what has been your experience with people being receptive to that and also their ability to transfer that, because it's a very straightforward formula or structure? What's been your observation and what kind of reports have people given back to you about using this in the workplace?
Yeah, you know, people are delighted that it's so practical and so scientific as to here's actually the formula for changing your behavior. So it's not kind of mystical. You don't have to go off on a retreat. You don't have to sacrifice a small animal. You don't have to hire a life coach or do anything like that. It's really practical. It feels like this is accessible to anybody. That doesn't make it easy, though. I mean, it's simple, but it's difficult because you're fighting those ingrained habitual. Habitual means non-conscious. You're not even really thinking about it. You're just in default mode. So it's tricky. And that's why, you know, building up other things like having a bigger picture about why you change this behavior, so a kind of a vision, an outcome, getting accountability, getting support around that, kind of tracking your behavior in some way, so you're kind of checking how you're doing. These are all additional things you can build around habits that can really help as well.
I think the bigger picture is something I'd like to have you talk more about, because one of the mistakes I can imagine managers making very readily is saying, oh, okay, I get the three steps. What I'm going to do is I'm going to write these statements for the people who report to me so I can correct their habits and they can do these habits instead without involving them.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, it's hard enough to write these things for yourself and have them be successful. If you're trying to write it for somebody else, you're really in a hiding to nothing. So, I mean, I think you've set this up so everybody listening is going to go, oh, I should avoid that. I think you're quite right. the most powerful thing to do is have people define this for themselves. But that's not to say that you as the manager or the leader can't guide them in that. You know, when they define the situation, get them to define the situation that they most want to change, you know, which would have the most impact if you did things differently. Oh, it's when I'm having this meeting with my boss's boss, or when I'm in this conversation with this person on my team who drives me crazy, you know, help them identify where the real challenge is to build the habit around, you know, help them brainstorm around different new habits that they could use. I mean, in the book, we offer 7 questions, so there may be something there. So there's definitely a role for you to play to support and encourage and help and hold accountable and check in with people. But I wouldn't write their habits for them. That's not a hiding to nothing. Nobody wins from that.
What I love is how you really illustrate and dimensionalize how the magic is in the interaction.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is... I like how you said that. The magic and the struggle is in the interaction. So when you're being that manager and the leader and you've listened to the podcast or you've read the book and you're like, okay, this feels good, I'm going to pursue this, you know, you will be pulled off course as soon as you get into this because you're like, oh, I just want to go back to telling them what to do, to giving them the advice. But if you've got the discipline and the courage and the willingness to be in service to the people who you lead and influence, then you'll have that greater commitment to be able to, in the moment, be more coach-like, which is where the power lies.
And I imagine that there are some cultures that are more ready and receptive to this than others. What are some of the characteristics that someone could use to kind of do a self-diagnostic as to whether this would be an approach that would work particularly well or particularly not so well at this time within their organization?
That's a good question. The organizations where I've seen this work best at is where people, perhaps a little overwhelmed, but still quite enthusiastic, or at least they're engaged in the work that they do. They want to do well for themselves. They want to do well for their team. They want to do well for their organization, but they're feeling perhaps overwhelmed by the amount of work, or they're feeling disconnected from the kind of the purpose, the why of the work that they're doing. Or they're feeling maybe that they've somehow built a team that's overly dependent on them now. You know, if you've got a culture which is a, you know, massively disengaged culture where people have kind of opted out, then this behavior change won't in itself be sufficient to kind of shift things around. But it really flourishes where people are going, look, we're trying to do our best. We're just trying to shift the way that we work around here so we can work less hard but have more impact. That's when this stuff can really thrive, I think.
In researching this book, first of all, what was the moment where you realized, you know, what we've been doing really merits a book? What was the epiphany that led you to say, oh, this has to go into a book?
You know, it's a longer story, but I actually wrote 4 very bad versions of this book before I got to this really good version of the book. So I'll just say that through kind of sheer hard work and perhaps a dash of stupidity on my side, writing it, then rewriting it, then rewriting it, just allowed me to try and get it, kind of pare it down to the essentials of what needed to be done. And of course, it's also deeply informed by our training programs, which are... you know, really have as its insight that coaching is just a foundational skill. You know, whether your organization's in tough times or is flourishing, whether it's big or whether it's small, coaching can drive resilience and focus and impact and engagement. So I was just going, how do I make coaching something that's a tool that any manager can pick up and go, that's not too weird, that's not too peculiar, I can probably do that, and here's the easy way for me to do that.
So, Michael, is what you're saying is that the first version of the book wasn't always the best answer to the question of how do I make this?
I like where you're going with that. Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah, it wasn't even close to being the best answer. In fact, it was a lousy. I mean, you know the saying, all first drafts are shit. Unfortunately, the second, third, and fifth drafts of this were pretty mediocre. So it's nice to have finally got to this place where I'm like, now we've actually cracked it. This is now a really good book, I think.
And was there input or perspective or something that added to the mix that helped you get to that breakthrough level? Or was it simply just keeping at it and the persistence?
Well, you know, ironically, I guess, or perhaps perfectly, it was hiring an editor. And, you know, I tried out a few and it didn't quite click, but then I found an editor who just, she understood what I was trying to achieve, and she had the ability to both see my vision for this book at the bigger picture, but also create some of the discipline and structure that I was missing up to now. So effectively I hired a coach, you know, that's in some ways what an editor is. A coach who was able to help me better realize the vision that I had for my own book.
You hired a coach to help you with your book the way others hire a coach to help them with their business.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, in coaching and in the book we're talking, we put such a lot of emphasis really on asking questions. But there's a place for giving advice. There's a place for expertise. I'm not saying never give anybody any advice ever again. I'm just saying slow down the rush to advice until you really know what the challenge is. And that's what Catherine, my editor, did. You know, she was curious long before she started giving me advice around how to change what I'd written. She really got to the heart of what I was trying to achieve, what tone I wanted, what outcome I wanted, and that allowed her to then offer up advice that was perfect.
So to the managers who are listening, I think there's a lesson in there about when you're curious, how does that affect someone's ability to influence the person who they're interacting with?
Here's the key thing. It made it clear that she was on my side. She was there to serve me, not just to bully me. And, you know, I worked with editors before, and it was honestly a bit of, in some of my previous books, and it was a bit, confrontational isn't quite the right word, but it's kind of their agenda versus my agenda. We think your book should be like this. I think my book should be like that. And we kind of have a little bit of argy-bargy to get that kind of clear and sorted out. With Catherine, because she stayed curious, because she was a good listener, because she asked great questions, it never occurred to me to think that she wasn't trying to create the book that I wanted. So that's another part of it, which is around, you know, the irony is you give advice going, I'm trying to help you here. But often advice creates resistance to the very help that you're offering.
That's right. Rather than it really creates a breakdown in trust and influence when you go for authority first, rather than truly looking to understand the problem as your first step.
I mean, there's a writer in this field of leadership, a guy called Edgar Schein, and you know he's mostly retired now. He's best known for his work on corporate culture, but his last couple of books were actually on the act of helping. And you know, in his book called Helping, he talks about this paradox of help, which is the more you try and thrust help upon people, the more you create resistance to the very help you're trying to offer up.
Well put. What was another surprise that you encountered in doing your research for the book? Because I'm sure as you dug down, you were working on certain assumptions and certain theories, and as you uncovered the research, it cast a different light on the experiences you had, and you said, oh my gosh, we've got to change something drastically.
Well, I guess you know, one of the things that I did, because we've been teaching these questions in various formats for some years now, so the questions and the content itself has been kind of well tested with real people in real situations, so we know that it's robust and that it works. But I wanted to bring to it more than just anecdotal success and field success. I wanted to see if there was some scientific background to that as well. So one of the things that I think was cool that we did is that for each of the questions, I hired a researcher, in fact, the same researcher who worked with Adam Grant on his terrific book called Give and Take. And Lindsay actually got into each question and kind of uncovered some of the science behind why each of these questions works. So, you know, in the book we talk about seven great questions, but if you're interested in the kind of the science that draws on psychology and behavioral economics and neuroscience about why these questions, then all of that's in the book as well.
Was there one point where you remember reading the research and it was just a thunderbolt of illumination for yourself, that there was scientific backing to something that you had been doing or something that had been working?
I wish I could say, yeah, exactly, and here's the piece of science that changed everything. But really, I'm not sure there was, I had a moment like that. But one of the things that I did love is that she had this ability to uncover some fairly quirky stuff. And there was this one moment. In the world of life coaching, which I don't spend a lot of time in these days, there's something called the miracle question. And the miracle question, which actually has its origin in solution-based therapy, the question is, look, let's say you go to bed tonight, and while you're sleeping, a miracle happens. And when you get up in the morning, things are fantastic. Things have really improved. But how would you know that? How would you know what things have improved? And people then get to kind of articulate a better life, a better day, a better experience. And what was interesting was the power of helping people imagine that and imagine, you know, it's like, don't imagine it being 10% better. Imagine it being kind of 10x better. That was an extremely powerful way to move people out of feeling stuck and in some cases out of kind of a state of depression. And what I loved about it, it was going, this question that I thought it's a kind of a bit of a lightweight question from life coaching actually has a kind of a robust pedigree from the world of therapy. And, you know, we don't offer that up as one of the questions in the book, but we do connect it to one of the foundation questions there, question number four, which is simply, what do you want? Because that's such a powerful question in terms of getting people to get to the heart of what the real hunger is for them. And once people are clear on what they want, that's actually a strong foundation for some really interesting action.
Can you talk a little bit about the lazy question that you refer to in the book?
Yeah. And, you know, it's a bit of a paradox of a title because the question is, how can I help? And when people hear that, they go, that doesn't sound like a lazy question at all. That sounds like it's more work for me. But here's what we're uncovering here. Often when somebody comes in to ask you for something or just starts talking at you, you kind of go, I think I know what they want. And you start providing it for them, whether they really want it or not. And by asking the lazy question, how can I help, or what do you want from me, as a kind of a slightly blunter version, what that does is it actually forces them to make an explicit request rather than an implied request. And what's powerful about that is if it's an implied request, that often leaves you a bit stuck because you kind of think you know what they want and you start giving it to them whether they want it or not. By making an explicit request, you then get to say yes or no or maybe to the response so that you can actually be more at choice as to what exactly you do for that person.
That's right. And I also hear that theme coming up again of helping people take responsibility. Because if I come to you, Michael, and I say, Michael, I really want to borrow the company flatbed because my brother-in-law is moving and we need that. You could say, well, no, that's not really legitimate and appreciate you asking, but that's not going to happen. Versus,
Right. Yeah. Say,
would it be okay if I kept that flatbed over the weekend, which is an indirect Right. Implied idea that we're going to do something with it, but it really doesn't responsibility for their making.
Yeah, exactly. So much of this is, again, slowing down the rush to action, just being able to be a little clearer about what the real challenge is, what the real issue is on the table, and then being able to be a little more mindful about what your response might be.
Michael, since you've studied habits and you've helped coach people to develop great habits, what are a couple of the habits that you use on a daily basis to run your company and serve others?
Well, I have to tell you that, you know, because part of what I do is facilitate and lead training sessions or keynote speeches and whatever. I have a habit that is how I respond to when a question is asked of me. Obviously not on a podcast interview like this, but in general. When somebody goes, Michael, sticks up their hand, how do I? Here's my very specific habit in response to that. Because obviously, as soon as somebody goes, how do I do this? You know, part of me is desperate to answer that, to prove that how smart I am. But instead of doing that, what I tend to do is this. I go, that's a great question. Thanks for asking it. And I do have some thoughts on how to tackle that. But before I tell you my thoughts, what are your first thoughts on how you deal with that? And then, you know, I'd nod my head and look interested to whatever their answer is, because they've always got an answer. And then I go, great, and what else? What else could you do? And what else could you do? And then I'll think about adding something at the end of that. So it's just a very simple habit, but it's a way of managing my own knee-jerk response to move to action. To say, when somebody asks me a question, I go, great question, glad you asked it. I've got some thoughts, I'll share them with you. But what are your first thoughts about that? And that works well in my when I'm managing my team, when I'm running a training session, when I'm giving a keynote. All of that can be really powerful.
Is there anything else come to mind? Another habit?
Well, I think probably the other one, and this draws on the foundation question, is when I find myself frustrated or annoyed or irritated or sad or discombobulated or something kind of slightly off the rails, the thing that I find gets me back on track fastest is sitting down and just reflecting on what do I want? What do I want here? Because what it means is somehow I haven't got what I want, so I haven't made clear what I want, or I haven't made clear the price of not giving me what I want. But often it's because I haven't actually got clear in my own mind what I want. And once I get clear on what I want, then things become possible in terms of me being able to ask for that or me being able to understand what my next action should be in this situation.
Well, Michael, you've been so generous in sharing ideas that you've gained from not only writing the book but interacting with clients, helping us understand more about looking out from becoming an advice-giving maniac, learning how to help busy managers in 10 minutes or less, which is an extremely effective approach in this very compressed and demanding work world that we're in, helping people focus less on advice giving and less of a rush to action so that we reflect on what really needs to be done and we align our resources in that direction, and emphasizing how the importance of small habits, because they dictate 50% or more of our waking behavior. So, Michael, thank you so much for sharing with us on My Quest for the Best.
My pleasure. It's lovely to be back with you. So thanks for having me along.